This is Talkish. I am Hella Kasserjain. The Hella Kasserjain Show is always available online at HellaKasserjain.com. Now, let's get to it. On episode 313, my guest is Andrew Revkin, the prize-winning science reporter and author who has spent a quarter of a century covering subjects ranging from the assault on the Amazon to the Asian tsunami, from the troubled relationship of science and politics to climate change at the North Pole. Now, out with a fun, fascinating, and enlightening new book, Weather, an illustrated history from cloud atlases to climate change. But first, my thoughts on the Trump administration's assault on the environment and the EPA. Let's talk. If the American Cancer Society told you that if you smoke in the room with your children, their chances for developing lung cancer would rise by an alarming rate. But a few scientists tell you, wait, not so fast. Maybe the science isn't there to prove it. But wait, that scientist happens to be a member of a political party that is in opposition to another political party and has deliberately taken the opposing political stand on the issue. What are you going to do? Are you going to blow smoke in your five-year-old daughter or son's face? Or are you going to err on the side of caution and not blow smoke into your child's lungs? Anyone who says that they will continue to smoke in front of their child until the facts are in deserves to be reported for child abuse. Don't like my argument? Let's try this. There is scientific evidence that if a young person sustains enough hits in the head while playing football, that young person is likely to develop brain dysfunction later in life. News stories about former NFL players diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the degenerative brain disease, better known as CTE, have parents rethinking their children's participation in some sports. On the other hand, there are scientists who say the data isn't there yet to fully substantiate the long-term effects of constant jarring of the brain on our youth. Now, your 13-year-old comes to you and says, "I want to try out for the football team." You're at least going to hesitate before you say yes, right? You're likely to err on the side of caution. If you don't, you deserve to be reported for child abuse. Sure, every day there's more and more data thrown at us warning us of the possible negative effects on our being from this, that, and the other thing. Some data we pay attention to, and some we don't. Not many stopped smoking when early reports came out of the devastating effects of tar and nicotine on one's lungs. But not many folks are still smoking cigarettes and blowing smoke in their children's lungs these days, are they? And sign-ups for youth football participation has declined substantially as worries mount about concussions known as CTE. But oddly, the very air we breathe, the very water we drink, the earth, which is our greatest gift, all creatures great and small, despite the warnings from scientists that were so dire that a Republican President Richard Nixon proposed the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency as an independent agency of the United States federal government for environmental protection, beginning its operation on December 2, 1970, nearly 50 years ago, are now being tossed to the wind by Republicans. Let's get away from science for a moment. Now itself considered an environmental hazard by the GOP. If you've lived on Earth as long as some of us have, you don't need a scientist to tell you that the climate has changed, the weather is different, the taste of the air no longer sweet as it once was. Even the color of our rainbows is muted in the filthy atmosphere that is the air we breathe. Oceans are rising as our polar caps melt. Extreme weather conditions are becoming the norm. The streets of Miami are flooded more often than not. Asthma is on the rise in children. Pakistan just recorded its hottest day in April ever, 122.4 degrees Fahrenheit. But back to smoke and mirrors. The games of the wacko science deniers in charge of our government these days. And EPA Commissioner Scott Pruitt, who is himself an environmental hazard, a climate change denier bought and paid for by the fossil fuel industry. From the land of shake, rattle, and roll, thanks to fracking, the world's earthquake capital of the world, OKLAHOMA, Oklahoma, not OK, Scott Pruitt, who under the guidance of a president who has his finger in the till of the Treasury of the U.S. and the banks of the oil barons of the world, has reversed and delayed numerous environmental rules, relaxed enforcement of existing rules, and halted the Environmental Protection Agency's efforts to combat climate change because it's good for business, if not children's lungs. While the GOP spends the people's money like it is water, not gas, on tax breaks for themselves, while they propose robbing the poor of their food stamps and Medicaid and air. As I said, we as a nation used to err on the side of caution. We no longer do that. Maybe it's all that carbon dioxide we're breathing, or the buzz to our brains we get from our mobile phones and computers. Could it be the plastic manufacturers that have killed our thought processes? I'm not sure I know the answer to these questions, but I do know this. We sure are stupid these days, because when we as a nation choose greed over our children's health and place our politics above our people and allow the likes of Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt to rape our environment for personal and political gain, it might be too late for our environment, but it is more importantly way too late for America, a nation under assault by a host of hazards, many a fully functioning EPA can't protect, but some only an EPA can. Only idiots would choose not to err on the side of caution. Idiots, a huge environmental hazard in Washington these days. Now it's time for Talkish and my conversation with environmentalist and author Andrew Rifkin. Let's get to it. Andrew Rifkin is the prize-winning science reporter and author who has spent a quarter of a century covering subjects ranging from the assault on the Amazon to the Asian tsunami, from the troubled relationship of science and politics to climate change at the North Pole. Since 1995, he has been covering the environment for the New York Times, but his first prize-winning magazine articles on the human influence on climate were published more than 20 years ago, before the creation of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's written acclaimed books on the Amazon, global warming, and the changing Arctic. His multimedia work on the web has also been widely lauded, particularly his New York Times blog, Dot Earth. He is the first science reporter to win a John Chancellor Award for sustained excellence in journalism. Now, following his prize-winning 21-year stint at the New York Times, Rifkin has taken a new position at National Geographic Society as the strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism to help expand grants and support for journalism worldwide. But today he joins Talkish to discuss his new book, Weather, an Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change, in which he presents an intriguing illustrated history of humanity's evolving relationship with the Earth's dynamic climate system and the wondrous weather it generates. It's time for Talkish. Let's talk with the fascinating Andrew Rifkin. Before we start, Andrew, I want to talk to you about this. Explain the difference between climate and weather. It appears that about 39% of Americans, if you get my drift, don't know the difference. Can you define that for us?
Well, I fall back on expertise as a wonderful climate and weather scientist named Marshall Shepard at University of Georgia, who puts it this way. He says, climate is your personality and weather is your mood at this moment in time. And it really works. Hopefully people understand. Everyone has a range of, you know, whether how angry you get or how worried you are. And that's kind of your personality. And then your mood is a function of what's happening around you and what you feel at a particular moment. And it's really the same. Weather, climate is the average conditions in a place over a period of time. Usually they judge it by around 30 years. And you look, so the average temperature on February 20th of any year through a 30-year period, if you average that out, you have kind of a normal. And then it's actually called the climate normal. That's the term. And then that gives you a sense of how to gauge if climate is changing. And weather changes all the time. So the weather on any particular day will rarely be the average. But there's a difference between that change and then the change in the climate.
So with Weather, an Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change, you set out to accomplish what? Let's start there, and then we'll go get into the weeds in a bit. But what was the overall arching reason you put this book together?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been writing about climate change and climate and weather and big weather events, tornadoes and hurricanes, as a news reporter for 30 years, magazines, the New York Times, and National Geographic Society. And this is the time, after 30 years of covering it something intensively, it's a time to step back and reflect. And and I thought it was fun to look at putting all this in a longer time scale. Like, it's sort of our species' learning journey on how the world works around us. And then increasingly in this 20th century and beyond, how we are shaping the world around us, including increasingly the climate. And so it's just sort of a step back process. And Lisa McKaley, my wife, who's the co-author, is a science teacher, middle school, and an environmental educator. And for her, this was an opportunity for us together to sort of make sure that this chronology is accessible to anybody. And it was just made it a great exercise. And what was really interesting was, after 30 years of writing about something, you think you know it, not all, but you know a lot. But I kept stumbling on stuff I had no idea about. And that was really, really exciting.
And you're a weather nerd.
Exactly. But I didn't know, for example, you know, I wanted to be sure we had the worst wildfire, the worst sort of weather-driven firestorm. Where was that? And I assumed it would be in the West, you know, California, the Rockies. It was in Wisconsin in 1871. I had no idea. And those kinds of things kept popping up, and that made it fascinating to dig in.
How fascinating was it to work with your wife on this?
Well, we're still happily married.
Glad to hear.
You know, we chose different roles. It was fun. I think Lisa's, she's always, you know, been interested in the environment too. So we just chose it as a, it was, what was really fun was, I wouldn't say it was a competition, but we were always looking for how do we make sure we have the right 100 items. And Lisa would find something and we would discuss something else. And the back and forth stuff made it really kind of dynamic and interesting, just the writing process.
I can imagine. And oh my gosh, this book is just filled with so much, first of all, great photos and stuff like that. But it's really a terrific compendium on all of this. You know, before we get into it again, like I said, I want to get into some weeds, but is weather changing? Is our climate changing? Does one influence the other? You know, there's such an argument about all of this. You've been writing, as you said, forever about it all. I don't know anybody who knows as much as you do, in a way. What are your thoughts on this?
It's been troubling to see how quickly the issue got polarized, in the sense that this sort of obscures the basic science. The basic science, way back in 2007, I remember Michael Crichton, the big novel writer in Jurassic Park and all that stuff, he was very skeptical and about global warming, but he did a debate that I wrote about that year, where he said, you know, greenhouse gases are real, they're making the climate warmer. His issues, which get to be, legitimate ones, were how much you respond, how serious is it, how much, whether people were overstating the case. And those are two separate things. And unfortunately, since then, it seems to have gotten to be even more oversimplified, to the sense that there are people who, in politics particularly, who use it as kind of an identity badge and won't get into specifics and won't say, well, here are the things I can agree with you on. And that's frustrating. There's a chapter in the book, actually, about some behavioral scientists found that there's even a term for this. They call it cultural cognition. And it's not just related to climate change. It's like vaccination or nuclear power or abortion, gun rights. When issues become kind of an identity badge, your adherence to your tribe, whichever one you're in, anti-nuclear, pro-nuclear, whatever, outweighs your allegiance to reality. And they find that, for example, these scientists who study cultural cognition at Yale have done research showing that the people with the highest basic science literacy on climate, you know, what's a greenhouse gas, that kind of thing, are not all bunched at one end of the concern. That there are people, the people who have the highest literacy on climate science are at both ends of the spectrum, people who are dismissive of it and people who are completely freaked out. So that's, as a writer particularly, that troubling because, you know, I spent my career assuming more good reporting could make us all think the same thing, and it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and there's
and that doesn't mean it's hopeless.
You're listening to Talkish with Hallie Kasser-Jane, The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. My guest today is author and environmentalist, his new book, Weather, Andrew Revkin. Talkish with Hallie Kasser-Jane posts new podcasts Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern at HallieKasserJane.com and is available via all your favorite apps. Be sure to find us on Spotify and on your Alexa device. Well, you know, it's interesting. If you've been on the Earth a certain amount of years, as I have and you have, there is no way that you can't even begin to understand that there is something going on. How the weather was when you and I were children and how the weather is now are like night and day. That's weather. The climate, too. The atmosphere. Everything is different. When you look through your eyes, you can see the difference in the air. Am I crazy or are you aware of this? So there's a certain amount of denial going on. That's very bizarre.
It is, yeah, but it still is legitimately hard to find even when that's clear. And it's clear in terms of, you know, when spring comes, when flowers emerge, it's still a harder task to say how much of that is due to the buildup of greenhouse gases from our activities. And things like extreme storms, it's even harder because, you know, the biggest storms are the rare ones. And their statistics is what you need to judge how much something is changing in a big way or whether there's a new force involved. And if something's rare, it's harder. And one thing that's been very valuable to me, and it's in this book repeatedly, is the body of science that's emerged by looking at what climates were like in the past. Or there's a fantastic body of work done that's revealed patterns of hurricanes in certain places where if you push a core, a sort of a metal tube down into a marsh behind the beach, you can see patterns of past hurricane activity in the layers of the mud. You get sand layers for a hurricane, and so it's like mud, 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 sand, mud, mud, mud. And that gives you a sort of a tracking, the history book for hurricanes. And that's how it becomes possible to know when something's truly new or not. And so it sounds boring to study the past climate, but it's really vital to do that to understand the present climate and then what's coming down the line.
The other side of that is that one would want to err on the side of caution if it wasn't political.
Right.
That is the part that go ahead.
Well, no, I didn't mean to interrupt, but there, too, for sure, I can find libertarians and liberals who will agree that, for example, the government programs that subsidizes flood insurance, where you can live in a zone that's going to flood, again, with or without global warming, and taxpayers end up bailing you out when the and there have been repetitive situations where the same property gets flooded over and over again. Those kinds of vulnerability issues can be dealt with today and not necessarily generate the political divisions. Same thing with clean energy. A wonderful reporter at CNN went to a county in Oklahoma a couple of years ago that surveys had identified as the most skeptical county in America on global warming. And he found good old average people on the street there who were getting off the grid because they're putting solar panels in their houses, not because they worry about global warming, but because they like to be independent. They're, again, sort of limited government, libertarian people who would never vote for a Hillary Clinton, but who are all about renewable energy when it can mean they can generate their own energy. I think that's exciting evidence that we can find ways forward.
I like that. That's a terrific piece to mull around in one's brain. You know, you might have titled the book "Weather: The Ultimate Illustrated History." I don't think there's anything you miss in this thing. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. I love it for that reason. The volcano fueled great dying that almost destroyed all life on Earth. But what about Ben Franklin's horseback chase of a whirlwind?
I love that one. Ben Franklin. He was, well, the first storm chaser. He wrote a letter he was an incredibly curious man. He wrote a whole treatise on waterspouts, and then he had a chance to chase a whirlwind, a small tornado, around 1755, I think, in Maryland, because he wanted to get close enough to it to see if he could disrupt it by passing his whip through it. He didn't quite get there, but what an amazing man.
Truly. Truly, truly, truly. Here's more. I've got notes. I'm going through these notes as I'm talking to you because I don't want to miss anything. There's so much great stuff in all of this. But you also walk us through weather-related inventions, from the windmill and the windshield wiper to the air conditioning. What did you uncover in your research that most surprised you?
Well, I guess one thing I hadn't learned about before was a woman from Alabama invented the windshield wiper, as we know it, the reciprocating windshield wiper, after a trip to New York City in winter when a trolley car, the driver was having a hard time keeping the windshield clean. She got back to Alabama and she sketched out, and she worked with someone. She was sort of a middle-class person with real estate, and she had someone who worked with her to come up with that thing, to wipe a rubber-tipped instrument to work across the windshield. The patent, which is now Google has a patent search, and you can read her words describing the system. Fantastic. And then the sad thing for her was that the automobile was invented and became a big deal too late for her to ever really make any money with her patent.
Oh, that's such a sad story.
1902. It expired before the car became a big deal.
Oh, my goodness.
Really, yeah. Anything with it. She's in the National Inventors Hall of Fame.
Well, that's good news. And it's a woman, which I think is really interesting, by the way, just because I'm one of them. But you discuss the human factor in weather disaster and why coastal communities are at risk. I need to talk to you about this. I live on the coast in Florida. We are drowning here. Mm-hmm. We are drowning. People don't realize. If you go down to Miami, I mean, the water is just all those high-rises. On those islands, they're inundated day in, day out.
Right.
The government doesn't want to seem to pay any attention to any of it. And, you know, everybody I know is going, I can't even sell my place because of the flooding. So is it too late for us? We got to talk about that.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. It's true that in the sense that, well, sea levels have been rising for 100 years, 8 inches or so the last 100 years, because the tail end of the last ice age, there's a long, slow warming. And what's going to come is more. It's hard to say how fast sea levels will rise from here to 2100 because of the uncertainties about the ice sheets. But it'll be substantially faster and more than 8 inches in 100 years. And so in that sense, it's too late. But it's in the human sense, it's never too late. We're an incredibly adaptive and resilient species. And if one thing that I've been sad about is that too much of the discourse around this part of the climate problem is sort of woe is me framing. And unless and until there are young designers and planners and architects who say, hey, you know, I'm going to design the city of the 22nd century, that there are ways to thrive in a world with this kind of change. I think we're more than capable of figuring that out. Florida, parts of Florida are, you know, history, for sure. It's a very low state. My article on global warming, my first piece on global warming, 1988, had a section on the Miami issue. And it's, you know, more so today. So it's
scary.
Those changes will be, it's scary, but the human way. We'll figure a way forward.
Well, you know, the part of that, you know, from a personal point of view, the scary part of it is that you can't get the political people in the state to pay attention to this with the current administration. We'll see what happens next time around, but everybody seems, you know, it's payola. I want to also talk to you about the Paris Agreement on climate change. Your thoughts on Trump's withdrawal from the accord? Your thoughts on this whole thing? I mean, can something like that actually help worldwide? And why are we playing games with this? Yikes.
Oh, it's, you know, I've been writing about this since before the first treaty in 1992. And the background forces that are driving the emissions of heat-trapping gases are really hard for the world to figure out how to stop. The countries in the world that still don't have a lot of energy are determined to use coal when they can because it's there. India, I spent time there last year. You know, there's 300 million people there who don't have any electricity. None. And that's why when Prime Minister Modi says we're going to burn more coal, even as we use more solar power, he's got justification. The Trump effect I wrote about when I was at ProPublica a year ago, is kind of limited. It, you know, the things they're doing in EPA are very significant, but they're more about their conventional pollution than about climate change. Weirdly, the good news about climate problems, it's way bigger than one president. The bad news with climate change is that it's way bigger than one president as well. it really is going to take time to work our way out of this fossil fuel conundrum. These fuels have been a great boon, 100 years of prosperity and connectedness and mobility and air conditioning and heating and cooling and refrigeration, and now we have to figure out some new ways to do those things. And one thing I've learned is that energy transitions take more time than we would like sometimes. Sustained engagement is really important. And Trump on Paris, he can't actually magically quickly withdraw. It's a four-year process, and of course, in 4 years, I'm not sure if he'll be president anymore.
I could say something here.
Cool question. No, I'll leave it to you to say.
But I won't. It confounds me. I can say it: the abject stupidity and arrogance of anybody who doesn't want to err on the side of caution, regardless of what they may or may not think. And then it's all about money. It's like putting the coal miners back to work in West Virginia, who never lost their job because there wasn't anything other than the fact that it's all been automated, whatever is, you know, still being mined in that state.
Right.
A little trivia. Hottest, and what's the coldest place on Earth?
The hottest, there was a recent revision of the chapter in the book on the hottest temperatures that Christopher Burt, B-U-R-T, who's a great weather historian at weather.com, Wonderground, which is owned by the Weather Channel now, He had written a book on extremes and had listed the place in Libya as the hottest. I think it was 134 degrees. And an expert on some of this stuff challenged the book, and he poked back at it and turned out that it was very unreliable reading. There had been a change in the thermometer and all kinds of things. And so that made it bounce back to Death Valley. But he did a closer look at the Death Valley reading that was the hottest there. And now that one looks like it's in the not clear either. So what the piece ended up being about is not so much the hottest temperature, but the challenges and opportunities in trying to clarify extreme conditions around the planet, hot and cold, which is kind of, and we're heading toward one of the clearest things about global warming is that hotter is hotter. when the climate gets warmer, there'll be more heat waves, and more of them end up in the hotter end of what's possible. And that's the thing to keep track of.
I thought the hottest place in on the earth was Washington, D.C., but hey, what do I know? I want to talk to you about rainbows. I saw a rainbow.
Muggiest,
for sure. The swamp. Did I just say that? I think I just...
Right.
Oh, my God. my producer's eyes just rolled. Okay, I'll behave. I want to talk rainbows. So this is one place near where I live. Every day there's a rainbow. Every time it rains, and there it is. And is there anything more glorious than the sighting of a rainbow? I don't think there's much. But the physics of rainbows, they are so special. Talk to me.
Well, yeah, everybody, as you say, from... the earliest accounts, even in stone, cave paintings, you can see rainbows in some artwork. Aristotle had his ideas. Theodoric of Freiburg came up with a theory in the year 1300. But it was it took until Descartes, this French philosopher and brilliant man in 1637, who really sort of broke down how light entering a drop of rain, which is spherical, but a drop that is hanging in the air, is refracted, it's sort of bent as it goes in, and then reflected back off the backside of the inside of the water drop, and then refracted again on the way out. And when you add that all up, it helps explain how the light, the visible light, gets split into the colors of the different wavelengths. And someone had to figure that out, and he was the person to do it.
Fascinating.
Cool. Although you don't want to take away all the magic.
No, because is there anything more magic than rainbows? No. Not much these days. I want to talk to you about this. Weather to me is like art. You know, when I was a little kid, do you remember those little tiny little books, like the Golden Book of...
Sure.
I still have mine. Would you believe? That's how much I love weather. And you can't live in Florida and not weather. What's the old line down here is, you know, just wait a minute and the weather will change. It's art to me. And it is so beautiful, even when it's dangerous. In fact, I think when it's dangerous, that's when weather is the most beautiful. You know, what was God thinking? So have we abandoned, as we abandon the country for the city, so much has been lost. And I know you approach weather from more of a scientific and historical point of view in the book, In Weather, An Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change. I want to keep saying that so people go get it. But weather influences human emotions. You touched on this in the beginning of our conversation. And it affects our mental health and our physical health. And I'm wondering, as we detach from our environment, which is what is going on, if you thought about how that affects human interaction, even our political dialogue, is there a way to fix this? Is this beyond your pay grade? People just don't seem to care about what they don't know. And in lies the power of your book and why people should pick it up and learn what they don't know if they're not living, you know, in a world that is affected by weather.
Yeah, I wonder about the same thing. The weather editor of the Washington Post did an interview with me over the weekend in a review of the book. He asked me if we produce a version of the book in the year 2500, could I imagine a couple of items that would be in it? And one of them I said, I hope isn't in it, that we become so insulated from the elements that we don't think that we would look back at this time, our time, as being a bizarre period when people had to think about grabbing an umbrella. And what I said to him is, I really think that would be kind of a loss. I said, I'd hate to think that there will no longer be the pleasure in the first fresh spring rain, in the jolt of a lightning flash, or the humility that comes when sailing into a gale at sea. I think we do lose something if we became insulated. And one of the things I was recalling in 2016, I was in Singapore, 80 miles from the equator, you know, tropical, humid place. Then they have this giant glass-domed botanical garden there where you can walk into the Mediterranean climate. It's the most bizarre experience. It's the air is like 70 degrees and dry, and they have olive trees and oregano bushes. And it just felt really weird to have to go into a big glass dome to experience that. And I would hope that we don't lose the connection with that world.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, there's another side to what you said, which is really important. And this is how, in many parts of the world, we're also insulated from the big vulnerabilities that come with exposure to hazards like droughts and floods. You know, poor countries are really sitting ducks today, and that the more we can do to help people in other parts of the world where they're not shielded even remotely from hazards like that, the better off the world will be overall.
Yeah, it's so important to look at it from that lens. I'm going to digress for a moment. I got two more questions. You're a songwriter, a multi-instrumentalist, and you got to play with the late, great Pete Seeger. Talk to me about that. And you're so multi-talented. Fascinating. The nerd who sings.
That was one of the great pleasures of my life. I had 20 years. I lived in the Hudson Valley, really right down the road from him. So we played frequently at local events. And he helped me with the lyrics in a couple of my songs. Fantastic giant of a man to be around.
Lucky, and lucky. Lucky.
There's not enough I could say about it.
Yeah. I hope you got a lot.
You could do a whole other
show on that. Maybe we'll have you back and we'll talk music. Weather and war, I want to end on this. It's not a happy thing to end on, but I think it's powerful and it's insightful, and it's something that you address. Weather, for instance, certainly got in the way in World War II on multiple fronts. Yep. I mean, one for Hitler, one for when we were invading. And I want to take that discussion back to weather and climate change and our environment, turning climate change into that political football that we were talking about. It may, to me, is maybe the single most dangerous result of these political fraught times. And it may be something...
Yes.
Go ahead. You want to pick it up? I don't even have to go further. You can you can pick up the ball because I know where I want to go with it.
Well, yeah, I think it is a shame because if you split it into two parts, as I said this a little bit earlier, how do we reduce our vulnerability to climate hazards? And what do we do about our energy future? It becomes a much more, much easier conversation to have, and one that crosses political divides. That as long as it's this kind of identity badge, simplistic, global warming, do you believe or not? Are you a denier or alarmist? It's just detracting from the real vulnerabilities that could be addressed today, right now, whether it's in a fire zone or a flood zone or a drought zone. There's a real opportunity there. Someone needs to be grown up and take us into that space.
I think my point being this, my point is that if they can't understand it on other levels, if it comes to meaning the difference between war and peace, winning a war, you know, and I'm talking to the hotheads on one side of the aisle, maybe. Mm-hmm. But you know what I'm saying? If you put it into that spectrum, maybe it becomes a much more important and less tribal issue. Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. So.
Which is why I wanted to end on that. Yeah, punctuate that. Yeah. So what didn't I get to? What do you want to say? What's your closing words to me as we close out of this delightful conversation?
Well, I guess I would say I really appreciated your talk. I'm happy to talk more. I think the next 30 years can be very different than the last 30. I think what I'm trying to do in this book is to create a baseline of understanding of just the amazing changes in our insights and how the system works and the vulnerabilities that can be addressed right now. And to really appreciate science as a great tool for helping build a better relationship with the planet around us, even as we become more influential to the planet around us.
Thank you, Andrew. You're delightful.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing. I've been speaking with Andrew Redkin. His latest book is Weather, An Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change. Find Andrew on Twitter at Andrew Revkin. Thank you so much for tuning in to Talkish with Hallie Castor-Jane, The Hallie Castor-Jane Show, a production of Resic LLC. Be sure to tune in to Talkish Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, when new podcasts are posted at HallieCastorJane.com and available on all your favorite apps. Like my commentary? Don't? Have a thought or two you'd like to share with me. I want to hear from you. You can always connect with me at HallieCastorJane.com. We have an active group on Facebook as well, the Hallie Castor-Jane Show podcast. Join me there. So, until next time, this is Hallie Castor-Jane.